Thank you very much. Okay, we are in a huge room, and we are so few. So maybe I don't know if people who are behind want to approach a little bit more. But well, we're going to start. And this panel is about funding and how to make it more efficient, how to ensure that it will have a real impact in the lives of people with disabilities. So today we have three speakers. And we are going to start with Mrs. Molly Harrington. Molly Harrington has worked for the British Columbia Public Service since 1994 and has been the Policy and Research Division Assistant Deputy Minister since September 2008. She holds a BA in Economics and History from the University of Toronto and a Master's in Planning from the University of British Columbia. Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah. So Molly is going to present us today social innovation and partnerships in British Columbia. Mm-hmm. Okay. And do you want to read your because maybe people can consult her biography so you can have more time to share your expertise with.
Okay.
Okay? Thank you very much.
I have 15 minutes.
Yes, please.
Good morning, everybody. It's a real pleasure to be here. And I tried to focus the presentation on what we're doing to creatively work with the financial constraints that we're now under to leverage more support for persons with disability and to increase employment outcomes in British Columbia. So just to give you a quick overview, I wanted to look at what we're doing in terms of engaging partners, which we feel is a critical success factor, what we're doing to beg, borrow, and steal from around the globe on best practices in social finance and innovation and some homegrown things that we're doing. And then also what we're doing to really rearrange the resources that are going into traditional programs to encourage innovation and individual choice to get better employment outcomes for people and to give people more support within the existing resources we have. Just a quick snapshot of Canadian data. This is from 2006, the last time we did the PALS survey, which unfortunately was the last time the PALS survey will be done. And I think people have seen these statistics before about the employment gap for persons with disability in Canada, which parallels the situation in British Columbia, and how that leads to lower annual average earnings and a higher incidence of poverty. So I think this parallels a lot of the information that we've seen this morning. In terms of engagement, what we're finding is the engagement itself is ending up being quite a powerful vehicle for getting more resources to the table and potentially, with some optimism, thinking of not only dividing up the existing pie, but also potentially making the pie larger. And so the diagram on the right really demonstrates how we traditionally have done policy, where it would be done within a civil service, and we would get some input from stakeholders and other government agencies to a much newer way of doing policy where we actually bring people to the table. And for this particular area, that would involve bringing people in the disability community and employers to the table, as well as all the other government agencies. And one thing we're really looking at seriously, and has been used around the world in many other jurisdictions, is using a change lab environment and really getting everybody to the table to focus over a significant period of time on a persistent problem and come up with transformative actions. And we're doing this actively right now in the community living sector with people and families, individuals and families living with intellectual disabilities, and getting our major financial institution. We have the largest credit union in the world in British Columbia, the Van City Credit Union, and other parties to actually really focus on what families and individuals want and to grow a system from those parties being at the table together. And we have been doing this for the last 6 or 7 years on our disability strategy. I know this slide is impossible to read, and it's impossible to read actually at up close, so I apologize for that, but it was really meant to really demonstrate the wide range of people we're bringing to the table, academic institutions, employers, and the wide range of disability organizations in British Columbia and all ministries. And what we have done in a very focused way to look at improving the employment rate and closing the employment gap for persons with disability is we formed a multi-party employment council. That should read Employment Council, not Employers Council, in British Columbia. So it's bringing the disability sector, the business community, government, nonprofit organizations, and families together to be very focused on how we can move forward. And actually, Susan has been kind enough to agree to come and spend a couple of days and spend a day with the Employers Council on Monday. And the other form of engagement we've had, which is quite intriguing, is with the range of insurers and employers. And they've come together, and they formed something called the BC Collaborative. And they're very focused at avoiding unnecessary workplace disability and a rapid improving the response and return rate of people that get injured on the job to coming back to work. And we've actually seen the beginning of some quite interesting policy work and potential success here about reducing the number of employees that get trapped into going onto long-term disability and eventually disability assistance programs. So we're quite excited about that. And as well with our community living sector, which is our sector with persons with developmental disabilities, we've struck a policy lab with them, and they're very interested in focusing on employment and housing and how we can move forward to improve outcomes on both of in both of those areas. In terms of adopting best practices on social finance, what we're very interested in, and we actually just launched, we had a committee external to government. I was actually lucky enough to be the government co-chair, as well as with our disability community as the chair, Alec Mansky, some people might know him, and our social finance and business community. Is we had a report back to government about how we can improve social finance and social enterprise in British Columbia. That report was just received by government last week. And what the government has done as a response is actually opening up its legislative and regulatory regime to better support social enterprises, which do actively act as quite active and positive employers for persons with disability in British Columbia. So what we did is we changed our corporate legislation to introduce a new public benefit corporation, a community contribution company, which is actually modeled on a UK an initiative for a KIC, a community interest corporation. And that company will be able to carry on, to have a vested benefit, social benefit purpose, and is a much more flexible structure than a traditional nonprofit organization, and also provides the ability to attract social finance by having a vested public benefit purpose. So it'll be a hugely important vehicle for investment in the social enterprise sector. We also created a social enterprise fund in partnership with Van City and our major foundation. And it has been able to make huge investments, significant investments in social enterprise firms that, again, are proving to be quite proactive employers of persons with disability and very focused on other benefits to the sector. We're actively exploring the possibility of a social impact bond in partnership with the federal government. And Sean and I have been talking about that on an on and off basis. And we're also very interested in what we can do with procurement to enter into community benefit agreements, again, with communities. And what has been arisen as a significant focus is improving employment outcomes for persons with disability as we use procurement. We're also very interested and focused on the tax system. And we have a proposal from the Social Innovation Council to put in place a small business tax credit for social enterprises to help them start up. And as well, we're very focused on the federal initiative of the Registered Disability Savings Plan, which provides significant pension benefits for persons with disability and how we can get our enrollment up in that benefit plan. Some much more applied, very specific initiatives that I thought you'd be quite interested in that are, again, very focused on improving employment outcomes for persons with disability is we have quite an exciting initiative, the Equipment and Assistive Technology Initiative. And what we're using it as, it's actually funded through labor market agreement funding from the federal government, which is about our only free board source of funding that the provinces have right now. And what we're doing there is it's a genuine act of partnership with the disability community, and it's co-managed, and it's meant to basically proof out that we don't have to have listed medical equipment services, that we can actually move into a much more self-assessment environment. So actually, for this program, people self-assess their disability. They're not tested or proofed out by any adjudication by government. And they self-define an employment goal, and they work with a series of super navigators who are their peers within the disability community to identify the barriers they have to achieving that employment goal, and what piece of assistive technology can help them overcome that those barriers. So that program's in year 4 of 5, and we've been able to provide assistive technology to about 700 people through that program. And we also the third replacement initiative we're thinking about, and that's in partial implementation, is community supports for independent living, which is meant as a replacement for traditional home and community care services. And it's using individualized funding and individualized planning to, again, work with a person with a disability to self-assess what their needs are and to be the consumer and if they choose to be the employer there. The third initiative is actually seriously exploring a much broader application of individualized funding and individualized planning. And with in particular application to persons with developmental disabilities and freeing up the funding that's provided in various program pockets with all of the adjudication ramps that you have to go through into one envelope that would be provided for the person over their lifespan. And they would be able, again, to self-determine how they would apply that funding. And definitely individuals and families are very interested in improving employment outcomes through the flexibility that that program can provide and is providing on a pilot basis right now. And the fourth initiative is a customized employment program, which is, again, for persons with developmental disabilities. And we've been very successfully working with employers here to carve out jobs within traditional workplaces that a person with a developmental disability can be matched up with. And one thing that's been very intriguing there is we found the key success factor is the and it's very focused on youth, is that youth that have had part-time work while they've been in high school are doing much better in that program. And as a result, what we're starting to do is work quite actively with the high schools. And the major transformational program there is we use the existing resources within the high school in a very different way. And we've been using the parents' advisory committees and as employers and as employer contacts and getting youth lined up with job placements during their high school, as part of their high school experience. And so just wrapping up, the challenge is, as with always, is data. lack of consistent data, disability data, and I know we share with the federal, or my federal government colleagues here, some disappointment about the disruption in our PALS data and continuity of data. It makes measuring outcomes exceedingly difficult. Access to technology and sourcing outside of medical suppliers, especially for employment. As soon as you get out of the medical system for assistive technology, you bring down your costs and you have much better access to accessible technology. And what we're working with the disability community as a successor to that EAATI program is coming up with a co-op where we can have some better collective purchasing power with suppliers and potentially some reuse elements in our assistive technology. Partnerships and engagement, and also obviously no templated solution is an imperative here. And it's also managing community perceptions that us moving into collaborative service delivery is as a source of offloading. So dealing with some healthy skepticism within the disability community, which I think helps keep people honest. Finally, some reflections on a couple of years into, or 5 years into this initiative, is that partnerships are key. Having the nonprofit sector, the business sector, and the government sector at the table is the only way that we've been able to move forward, and we actually have been successful in moving forward and tapping into traditional corporate social responsibility funding, using our programming in a much more flexible way that is client-centered and client-focused with the employer at the table. Youth focus is key, and part-time jobs in high school have emerged as, in many ways, potentially somewhat surprisingly, as a critical success factor to improving employment outcomes. And assistive devices and technology are obviously key. So I'll end there to leave my colleagues with the time that they deserve. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Molly. Well, our next speaker is Mr. Hervé Bernard. Hervé Bernard has been working for Handicap International for more than 12 years and is currently the head of the Inclusion Technical Unit at the headquarters of the Federation in Lyon, France. Please, go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon. When I've been invited here for this session in Quebec, I say, great, it's an opportunity for me to speak in French in a francophone country. But unfortunately, I've been said that McGill is an anglophone university. So once again, I will speak in English. But excuse me for that it is not my native language. I will focus mainly on two issues, developing countries and microfinance, which are often forgotten issues when we talk about employment and work in this main conference at international level. I will go through quickly through our global vision of livelihood within Handicap International as an international NGO, a vision we share with many stakeholders, and different methodology we follow, like the personalized social support, which is very important for us, our vision of inclusive services. And of course, I will focus after mainly on microfinance and how we can work for an inclusive microfinance for persons with disability, and what are the main recommendations or good practice we have identified within the different place where we work. So just very quickly, quick information where HI gets its legitimacy to speak and credibility, because we are present in more than 60 countries with 30 years experience now, our very local proximity level, small project, but that can give us a little bit of knowledge of what's going on right now. So our vision of livelihood is that, of course, if you want to make a living, you need, most of the time, you need to work. And to work, you can be self-employed or wage-employed. Most of the people in developed countries are wage-employed, and in developing countries are more self-employed. We talked about that this morning already. Social protection is a key issue. I will not develop, but it's also very important. We mentioned that with the World Bank initiatives to see whether we can also propose some livelihood with some social protection, social assistance, social insurance mechanisms. For self-employment, as it is our main issue in developing countries, two things are important: access to skills and access to fundings, access to financial services. So we will we'll see in my speech that we will focus mainly on the access to finance
but completely agree with what has been said before, that skills are also a very important issue. So, as I said, self-employment is often the only solution for people in developing countries, even if multinationals are coming now in most part of the world with an offer for industries and for jobs. But most of the time, the only solution is to get your own business and to start something. We have a methodology following this twin-track approach that has been defined by the FID for the women issues, working on the two tracks. On one side, we have to develop a society, and specifically all livelihood services, economic services, employment services should be open and should be inclusive to the whole population on one side. But on the other side, we should be able also to develop specific measures that help this specific population of persons with disability to get empowered and to have access to these inclusive services. For that, we believe that we have to work at two levels, the level of the person and the level of the environment. It's online also with the social model of disability, so we'll not go too deep in that. But it's very important for us to understand that we have to slowly work with a person and to help this person to cope with this very diverse environment where economic actors are part of the diversity, but you have also all the social, the health system, the community, the families, and of course the association, all the collective movement. So concretely, when you talk about one person, on one side we try to see how we can raise the capacities of the person to fit with the job market, I mean soft skill, hard skill, professional skills, and on the other side, to follow this twin track, we have also, of course, to adapt and change the job and the services working with them to be sure that they can fit with person with the capacities of the person. So always try to balance these two issues when we work with persons with disabilities. So to be able to move forward with this notion of self-employment, we decided to run a survey worldwide to try to identify good practices. Good practices are very well fashioned these days following the UN Convention to try to find what works. So we decided to have this this survey, and this is a document we produced now six years ago, focusing on how can people get access to self-employment through a better access to funding mechanisms, because I mentioned that funding mechanisms is a key issue. We already followed this survey with a training kit that will be soon available, and also we presented this document in many conferences like the World Microfinance Summit in Spain last year. The objective was to identify the key issues for people to get access to financial services for self-employment, and at the end to see whether that participate to the economic inclusion of persons with disability in one community. So I go quickly through different phases, but it's interesting to see that we try to look at the literature, and there's a lot of literature about microfinance, but microfinance disability is very poor. Regarding this literature, we identify some interesting supposed good practice. About 58, 60 good practices have been identified around the world, and so we try to visit them concretely in Africa, in Asia, in Central America, and we did some workshop, some discussion, and to finalize at the end this document. What are the major findings? Once again, figures. We can debate about figures, about data, like we did during the lunch, but what we identify, and it's not something that is statistics that is worldwide with all the official statistic requirement, but what told us, the microfinance institution, that whether they don't know if they have persons with disability as a client, or if they know, it's very little, 0.5% of their clients were identified as disabled, so nearly nothing. So the main buyers, and if we go through the speak of the people when we talk with them, we had on one side a microfinance institution saying, we haven't thought about that. There is probably not so many disabled persons running viable businesses. We don't have any knowledge on how to serve this segment. They talk about segment in microfinance. We need special products to serve this segment. or we are too busy to think about it, and we have too many challenges to face, sustainability and all this financial issue. But on the other side, it's interesting to see also the voice of persons with disability, and what did they say? Microfinance are money hunters, so we don't want to deal with them. Borrowing money is too risky. Because of our situation, we should receive grants. What is microfinance? Never heard of that. They would always refuse to consider us as clients. I try many times, every time they close the door, and they can't even access, I cannot near, access the nearest branch because it's too far from my home. So this is different, the two different feedback we had from these two important actors, the personal disability and the microfinance. So it's interesting to see that, in fact, the challenge is double. On one side, we have the personal, at personal level of the person, a big challenge to feel comfortable to go and to become a client of microfinance institution because of what we could say self-exclusion or lack of self-esteem, lack of motivation, lack of know-how, education, of course. They can sometimes expect something else, not credit, expect charity, expect special condition. So that's an important barrier for them to access microfinance. And of course, on the other side, we have the microfinance institution that have bad attitudes, product design not adapted, not flexible enough, architectural barriers, no frame, no policies, all these issues that said that they are not ready to welcome this public. There are some technical barriers. I will not go too deep in that. It's more technical for microfinance people, but they have a lot of technology. They use groups. They use weekly repayment, compulsory savings, credit history, all these very rigid techniques that sometimes are bringing barriers for people to get access when you need more flexibility and more adaptation to your remote area, to your capacity to walk, to transport, and stuff like that. But one of the main barriers is accessibility, in a general understanding of accessibility, the location of the branch, the transportation, the cash counter simply, is it accessible to get to the cash counter, and access to information. What can I do, when I should I repay, and all this information are not accessible for most of the people with disability. So our conclusion was that we need to move to a partnership, because these two worlds, the social world of personal disability and the microfinance world, very experiment in financial and credit and banking issues, they don't talk to each other simply, and they don't know each other enough to be able to work together. So that means that we have to focus the mainstream microfinance institution, because they are there. You have microfinance institutions everywhere in the world today, even in North Korea. So let's try to see how we can get to this structure, to this mainstream structure, but they have to change. They have to get ready now to move towards inclusion. So I mean, we have to raise awareness. We talk a lot about that for enterprises, but it's the same issue for microfinance institutions. Simple adaptation most of the time, training professional, training credit agent at the beginning once they receive the on-the-job training, new rules, new policies, and establishing partnership with people with disability, with social services who work on the other side of the inclusion. Concretely, that means that you have on one side the microfinance institutions that have to be adapted, and we have to help them to get adapted, but they must remain the one providing financial services because they are professionals and it is their core activity. And on the other side, and we cannot ask them to do social work. It's not the job of a bank, even if it's a microfinance institution, to do social work. So on the other side, we need to develop social services that are able to provide self-confidence, capacity building, mentoring, coaching, peer support for persons with disability to be able to go and reach the microfinance system. It can be done by disabled people organization, can be done by social actor, by the state, but in a context where the state are more and more looking for private services, and also less and less money to put and budget to put in social affairs. So that's a complexity of the task. So we decided to launch a Microfinance for All Alliance. It's a very informal platform. We did that with IDDC, which is an International Disability and Development Consortium. It's a consortium of 25 NGOs in Europe working for disability and development, because we consider that we have to put together in one platform, one alliance, microfinance institution and organization working for people with disability. Because that's the only way that people can meet, can talk, and can decide country per country, commune per commune, to say, let's work together in this particular place of the world to see whether we can be more efficient and can share our expertise on microfinance and disability. So this alliance is quite simple. On one side, you have the international actors of disability that have a very good contact with local organizations at field level, with working with disabled people. On the other side, you have the big, major international actors on microfinance, like Action, for example, in USA, but we have a lot also in Europe, and they work with local microfinance institutions at the field level. But there's no bridge between these two worlds. So we have to build these bridges at international level through, hopefully, this alliance, and at local level with concrete connection between local structures and local organization of persons with disability. So as a conclusion, I would say that this survey shows that some interesting good practice exists, and every time that it's a good practice has been raised, that it's because this partnership was very active and very efficient, and the bank realized that personal disability can be a good business and can be successful to pay back their credit. And we have to move forward in this direction to build better relationship between the professionals of microfinance and the other side. We have to empower people's ability to be able and to feel confident that they can be a user, a customer of this kind of system. So don't hesitate to contact us and to also to read this document to see whether you could also be part of this process and imagine some concrete partnership in your country, within your location, because as you can see or not in this picture, it's just showing Hamed, who was in Central Africa, who just started 3 years ago with a little income generating activity as a tailorman in a very remote and rural area, and it was the first step for him to become a self-employer. And 2 years later, he managed to recruit 4 people. And these people now is a small micro enterprise. It's completely informal. We are still in a place where we are far away from wage employment, from micro enterprise. But it is how it works in most of the developing countries, and that's the way we would try to develop microfinance inclusive. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Hervé, for sharing this experience of Handicap International. And well, now we are going to invite Dr. Michael Fernberg to please start his presentation. Dr. Michael Fernberg is Program Manager of the ESSEL Foundation and Head of Social Affairs of the Baumax Group in Austria. He started his career in journalism in 1985 as freelancer for the Gewinn magazine, a leading Austrian business magazine. Between 2000 and 2007, he was editor-in-chief. In 2007, he started the non-profit organization Antara Solutions, an incubator and bridge builder for aid-worthy education projects. In 2009, He initiated the first yearbook on corporate social responsibility and started the Austrian philanthropy group. Thank you. I think that you can read also his biography. I'm sorry, I cannot speak German. But in 2010, he joined the ESSEL Foundation, a leading Austrian charitable foundation, as program manager and the Baumax Group, who has 11,000 employees, turnover one, I don't know how to read this, as its head of social affairs, being a moderator responsible for the ESSEL Social Prize and the employment of persons with disabilities within the Baumax Group. So th- Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for the kind introduction. I'm inclined to say now to something completely different, although we're staying in the same workshop. First, we had an approach from a government side, a very interesting one. Then we had one from an NGO side, and now you're listening to an approach from a foundation side. Something completely different also because you have to adapt to my German accent now after the French accent. And the Spanish one. So it keeps you awake at least. And also something different because we have an approach that's very, we try to be very universal, very worldwide, very low barrier, accessible to everyone. And we also ask you and want to encourage you to somehow take part in our initiative, which is called Zero Project. I want to start with a brief introduction about who is behind the Zero Project, meaning the ESL Foundation and the World Future Council, then giving you some details about the project itself, and then give you some insights how we developed this, what we learned, what mistakes we made, and why it is like it is today, and also giving you some prospects for what we are up to and what we are planning for the near future. Well, first some words about the ESL Foundation. This is the couple that have founded the ESL Foundation. ESL is not an acronym, it's the family name of these two persons. It's Martin and Gerda ESL. They own the Baumax Company Group. Baumax is a group of stores that works in 9 countries, which sells home improvement and do-it-yourself products. I think in this area, Home Depot is most well known, which is a similar kind of company. In the area that we are in these 9 countries, it's rather big. It has a big a turnover of 1.6 billion euro. It has 11,000 employees. And it has 260 persons with disabilities employed in that company. And this gives you one reason why we developed the ESL Foundation in the direction that it is now. The company has a long tradition, more than 30 years, in employing persons with disability. It has developed various approaches to foster cooperations with NGOs and at some point started hiring persons with disabilities and developed a real program in this, but this is not my topic today. It's very interesting to talk about, but just to mention this, where one reason why the ESL Foundation is doing what it's doing. This is how the stores look like. And the mission is supporting social innovation and social entrepreneurship. Since an entrepreneurial family is behind the foundation, it has this entrepreneurial spirit and it has the knowledge about the importance of innovation, and it has its second mission in working for a world without barriers. And this is also the motto of the Zero Project. These are some other projects from the ESL Foundation. It started with the ESL Social Prize, which is a prize which is awarded annually for social entrepreneurs and new innovations, which is 1 million euro per year. And together with the Zero Projects, these are the two main projects. The World Future Council is our partner in the Zero Project. There's Ingrid Heindorf sitting in the first row who represents the World Future Council. So if you have any further inquiries about this very strong partner that we are very happy to have, please, you can approach her any time after the workshop, of course. They have contributed a lot to the work of the Zero Project. I'm not going into any details, but if you have further interest, please feel free to contact Ingrid. As mentioned, the mission of the Zero Project is for a world without barriers, meaning trying to remove all barriers that stand in the way for persons with disabilities in order to support the implementation of the UN Convention. What are we doing? We are trying to highlight good practices and good policies, and we are developing systems to measure the implementation by social indicators. And we're not doing this alone. As mentioned, we are trying to act as a catalyst, as a platform where experts, where NGOs, where parliamentarians, where academics can contribute, and it's absolutely necessary that they do, since we are not the expert. We're coming from an entrepreneurial side. What we are trying to do is be as helpful as possible, to have as low barriers as possible for everyone to contribute, and so far we've been quite successful. It's a work in progress, and with a highlight at the beginning of this year, we had a conference in Vienna with 200 participants from 30 countries, with a really intersectoral approach. Many people from not only various countries but from various sectors were coming: parliamentarians, foundation, NGOs, academics, international organizations. And what we did is we sent the whole conference one day only on discussing just 8 good policies. These good policies were nominated by a large group of nominators, and they were selected by a scientific advisory board from experts all over the world. Everything is very transparent and can be shown in the Zero Project report. I've brought one copy. I leave the copy here, and I leave it to the organizers what to do with it. So every details can be seen in the Zero Project, and it's also available for download on the Zero Project website. Yeah, and I'm quite happy to tell you that we also had one of these good policies was one from Canada, from British Columbia, and it was this system of representation agreements that Christine Gordon, we were happy that she came and presented this at the conference in Vienna. We found a partner in Austria who organized the conference for us and paid for all the venue and the catering, which was an Austrian bank, Bank Austria. So it's also a system where we can invite other partners, probably also in other countries, that do this together with us. So if someone is interested and wants to share this knowledge that we have, we are open to this kind of cooperations. At this stage, we have more than 100 contributors and partners from 35 countries who help us select the good practice, good policies, and have the social indicators ready for the report. This is the country list of 2011. In 2012, we will hopefully have more than 50, probably even 60 countries in the country list. So my colleague Tom Butch is doing a wonderful job here. We will have countries like Myanmar, like India, like Pakistan, and even Afghanistan added this year to the country survey. Just to give you a brief intro in our learning curve, where we started and where we are now. First, we created something which was called the ESSEL Social Index, just trying to focus on social indicators, because there are some really successful examples of what good created social indicators can achieve, like the PISA study, which is in Europe and in the OECD countries a high impact on the education system, and also the African Development Index. We defined fields where we wanted to work. We developed social indicators together with a university from Munich, and we developed 44 social indicators. Included the whole Austrian and some also international experts, NGOs, in developing these indicators. So this cooperation aspect was there right from the beginning, and we published a pilot study in November of 2010. It was quite easy to find partners, since we didn't ask a lot from them. We didn't ask for any money. We didn't give any money, but since it was only about, most of the partners had just to fill in a questionnaire, we were quite successful in attracting, finding partners in 15 countries who contributed to our first survey. But what we learned is that we have to focus, and so we focused on disability, since this is closest to the company culture. And what we also learned, that what we included as a kind of byproduct in the first pilot study was good practice. There were some really interesting ones, and we said they are so interesting we have to include them, although we didn't intend to do that. But we found that that they are highly relevant and they were highly cited in media. So good practice was something that we learned we should put in the focus of the future Project, which we at this time changed to the name of Zero Project, also to indicate that this is an open platform, that this is an open source that's not owned only by the ESL Foundation, but that it's ready for partners. We found the World Future Council as a partner with their expertise in selecting a good policy. We make a division between good policy, meaning regulations, and good practice, meaning all kind of innovations more on the bottom-up side. And we develop both now independently. Yeah, I gave you these figures already. So in 2011, we were ready to launch a website where the results of our 2011 research was included. And in 2012, in January, so only 4 months ago, we had this conference that I mentioned already, and we were very proud of the success of this conference. As you could see, we had not only a good atmosphere, but very international people there, and what we hoped that we could achieve happened. People were really interested, were really eager to talk to each other, and everyone recommended us to continue our work. But what we learned is that we should focus on a topic every year, and we decided to start with employment. So our current work, which is quite exciting, is focusing on disability and employment, and we will choose another topic every year. We also include in the current work a good practice on the same level as good policy. With on the good practice side, we are cooperating with Ashoka, as you some of you may know of this organization. And they, as World Future Council is doing the work on the good policy side, Ashoka is doing the work on the good practice side. As mentioned, we will, in addition, have social indicators for hopefully at least more than 50, probably even 60 to 70 countries. And what we also lucky to be in a position, we are approached by many organizations that ask us to do conferences and presentations together with them. On 21st of June, we are very happy to have a presentation in the European Parliament. So my final words is, once again, if you think you can contribute something, we are very open to all kind of corporations, from nominating good practices and good policies up to the very high end of organizing a conference together with us. We are open, we want to do what is necessary. We are not a self-relying and self-sufficient organization. We want to do what's in the best interest of persons with disabilities. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and Dr. Fenberg. So we're now we are open for a session of questions and answers. So please, we have a microphone.
First of all, I'd like to say these great presentations, very interesting, and to get the three perspectives was really valuable, so thank you for that. And I'm wondering, first of all, and it's not my question, but will it be possible to get a copy of the PowerPoints? Yep.
They'll be posted on our website.
Okay, terrific, thanks. Okay, my question really is for a couple of questions for Molly, and about some of the stuff in your presentation, which was very good, by the way. I guess we're all looking at this move towards social impact bonds and how it's going to work. Clearly, there's a lot of questions coming up at this point because people are very either confused or excited or both. I guess one of the first things is, if we're something that's been around really since 2010, I hesitate to call anything a best practice at this point. Given that social impact bonds are driven by investment, and that the activity has to be attractive to the investor, how, for those of us working in certain sectors of the disability movement, if what we're doing isn't sexy enough for an investor, how do we ensure that work still gets done? It's important. The supplement to that is you mentioned BC Community Living as an example. And the Arjun Langford research that was released in March 2011 actually identified a problem with BC Community Living in terms of social impact bonds, in that a demonstrated customized employment program that was working well was not deemed worthy of SIB because the return, the savings for the government weren't going to be adequate enough. And consequently, the funding was lost for one of the customized training programs. So I'm just wondering how we're going to deal with that, particularly in light of CRPD Article 27, where there has got to be access to employment. Now, I guess from the independent living perspective, we have 27 centers across Canada doing tremendous work, almost all engaged in employment with people with disabilities at some level. We would count as a really, really fantastic success or outcome sometimes if a particular consumer managed to get out and do volunteer work for a couple hours a week or managed to get into pre-employment supports. But those aren't going to, how are those going to fit with how are those going to be measured as positive outcomes for the investor, and why would they want to invest in them? Thank you.
I think I would agree with your healthy cynicism about social impact bonds, and adopting best practices. I think there's only really one social impact bond, and correct me, Sean, if I'm wrong here, that's really up and running, and it's in its early stages, which is the one in the UK in the Peterborough prison system to test whether, you know, mentorship and a cluster of interventions will bring down government costs related to reducing recidivism rates. You know, and I think, you know, I'm not speaking out of school here, that they've had to keep edging it back. So the proof is not there. That said, it's caused a huge amount of interest. Maybe some of it somewhat romantic in many jurisdictions in Australia's and the United States, and certainly members of the nonprofit community actually in British Columbia are very interested in it. And when we did the social innovation report back to government, there was sufficient, actually vigorous interest in government continuing to explore it. We're going to have to work cooperatively across the provinces and the federal government to get something that potentially is a viable model. I'm not convinced that current model is viable. And again, I would invite Sean to make some comments on it as well. I think it's our perspective is fairly consistent. But maybe I'll just say something specific response to your question about customized employment before I do that. Is that okay, Sean? So on the customized employment program, I'm not familiar with the report that you're talking about. So I'll talk to you about that offline. But I think the customized employment project is showing really the way forward. So it was funded initially as a pilot the pilot period ended at the end of March, I believe. And what we've done based on how promising that practice was, we've integrated it into our new employment programs as something that's going to be available. I don't know that it'll be as rich as that initial pilot was, but it is integrated into the entire new employment programming for across the province. And CLBC, Community Living BC, is doing a huge amount of consultation now on how do we move forward with the next stages of employment. So there's an active commitment, and that pilot phase of the project is over. And I was not even aware that it was even considered for a social impact bond, and I think we're so early in the social impact bond thing. I think the problems are with the social impact bond. They're not with the customized employment program. So I hope that answers your question, and I'm happy to talk to you offline about it too.
Thank you. Okay. I guess it's just, yeah. One of my biggest concerns yeah. Who's going to see
Oh, yeah. So one of the reasons I'm somewhat I'm struggling with the social impact bond is about the metrics, right? So what it is, for people that aren't aware of what is social, the concept of a social impact bond is that a financing agency outside of government, the most likely suspect is probably a foundation. Foundation would entertain the possibility of putting some investment money on the table, working with a cluster of nonprofit organizations or organizations to test out a new intervention, to see and invest in that intervention for a period of time, and be in a performance contract with government. So the three parties are at the table. And then they would test out whether those social outcomes were borne out over time. And government struggles to measure everything. And the break in continuity and disability data in Canada now is an additional challenge. And then the payback the foundation would then potentially be in a situation where government would entertain reimbursing the foundation, giving them a return on investment if the metrics were borne out and if government saved money.
Does your model use the intermediary model? Like you've got NGO, government, investor. So let's see, you can ensure there's no conflict here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so it's, and again, that's the concept. That's the purity of the concept. I don't even know that we can potentially even deliver on the purity of that concept. Okay. But maybe this is a good segue to Sean actually making a few comments, right?
Yeah,
we're struggling here, right?
Okay. Yeah. I think first and foremost, the most important thing to say is that what hopefully in Canada we will brand as community benefit investments, because they're not bonds.
Yeah.
So we're trying to change the language just to kind of get a better starting point in terms of the discussion. But I think first and foremost, it's important to accept that this is but one tool in a basket of tools that would be called social innovation. It is not going to work everywhere and in every sector, partly because the metrics will be really critical, partly because being able to develop business models that allow you to create the partnerships between the private sector, the not-for-profit sector, and government will be, I think, really fundamental. And so you start with metrics, and then the other side of that is, even if you can measure it, can you get it to scale such that there is a reasonable savings to the Treasury? And so the fundamental premise, and there are a whole bunch of varieties in terms of how you do this. We are working in my department in the federal government, public safety, looking at a much cleaner model that would see the government enter into a pure contract with a financer. We would leave it to the financer to find their deliverers and to build their business model. The Brits obviously developed a model that has an intermediary. Where we see the downside of that is, in order to get that intermediary up and running, the actual first investment was made by the British government. The pure theoretical concept of these investments is the government puts no money up front. The government only pays at the end if there's success. So it's also premised on a very different sort of management technique or approach to looking at the risk of pursuing these projects. So there's only the one actual project up and running. The Brits have, I think, now announced four or five more of these. The Australians have an approach to what they call social benefit investments. And theirs is actually to see if they can develop the market without getting initiatives off the ground. And so they basically put out a call that says, come to us with your ideas and your business proposals, and we'll negotiate with you to see if we can get this market going. The ultimate goal, long, long term, is that you actually do create a marketplace. We're working with VanCity, for instance, to look at whether you could ultimately see, as part of a portfolio of investments, that they would be able to make these as offerings within a portfolio where you could really encourage financing that would come from sources outside of government. Again, it'll only work in certain sectors, and it'll be really dependent on you know, really smart business models that can get you the metrics, so that you start with an understanding of a common baseline of the data, and that you can then also have a reasonable process for evaluating your success in terms of the growth in those metrics. You don't want to end up in 5 years after running a model in court arguing over whether you succeeded or not. And at the end of the day, the government will pay out based on that contract that was established at the beginning. theoretically it should work, but it really will be critical upon finding the right set of partners. In Canada, there's absolutely a network here that is interested in this. I have surprisingly never had a financer walk out of the room saying not interested. They keep coming back to our meetings. There seems to be a growing social finance world here that is really interested in this, what we call double bottom line investing, which is we want social outcomes, but we also want a rate of return on our investment. And they're trying to find those balances.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, please. We have time for... No, yeah, we have what, two more questions or one question? No, please, madam. No, oh, I don't know who.
No, first,
yeah. I'm sorry.
I just want to reiterate what everyone else has said. These are terrific presentations, and I just want to thank you. It was wonderful to hear all four of you, and it was really great. Just as a rejoinder to what Sean was saying, I was involved with starting a Center for Nonprofit Management in the province of British Columbia, and we were funded by Coast Capital Savings, which is a credit union, second largest after Van City. And the reason that they invested in nonprofit management was because they recognized that many of their customers were nonprofit organizations. So it was a return, and they found a terrific piece. But I really wanted to come to you, Michael, because I'm fascinated by indicators. They're part of my métier, and I love them. So can you just say a little bit about what the quality of the indicators are and whether or not they're specific to persons with disability and or do they have broader applications? And just if you could illuminate that for us, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, just some brief words on the indicators. What we try to do is be somehow complementary and give added value to all the data that is around and that is published by the institutions that we all know. So what we try to do is create very simple questions where very decisive answers can be given so that we don't ask, for example, is Article 27 of the convention already implemented or not, but we would ask a question very detailedly related to employment. For example, we are thinking of a question asking, is the percentage of persons with disability going up or going down relatively to the overall percentage of employment? What we add is a traffic light system so that our experts, and it's an expert panel, if we don't have any other access with our financial means, it's an expert panel questioning. They answer with yes, with qualifications or with no, and give explanations to why they're giving this answer. And part of the value that we create is of course in the additional information why the expert says in country X why it's only yes with qualifications because. So this is the system. We got 21 indicators that we ask every year. So we want to create also a sustainable development that can be seen in the report. And we want to ask additional questions for the topics that I mentioned. So, sorry, this year it will be employment.
See, we're fighting for the right to ask questions. I wanted to talk to Heve about that very interesting work on microfinance. Two questions. One, are you seeing a real shift in the attitudes and willingness to cooperate on the part of the microfinance sector? And so more than just little hotbeds of okay, but somehow a shift in the sector. And secondly, you know, we're working with a lot of multinationals. How could a multinational network, you know, we're looking at a global business forum on disability, how could it help you to influence the microfinance sector? Was disability and the microfinance sector on the last Davos agenda? I bet not. Could we help to get it there, if that would be helpful?
Yeah, thank you. Is there a real shift? That's a good question. I would say yes, because I'm optimistic by nature, and because we have some kind of proof that things are slowly changing. I think microfinance have been quite a long way now. It started in the 80s with the Grameen Bank success stories, with the Washington conference with Mrs. Clinton at that time. pushing a lot for that. And after, like every story, you have the moment that the story begins to have some also bad stories. And I think we are more in a mature phase now for macrofinance when they realize that sometimes they have been too far in terms of finance-oriented strategy, and maybe they forgot the poorest of the poorest. And I think most of the macrofinance now recognize this fact, that they should be more social-oriented, and they have to be more creative to imagine that how they can maybe flexible a little bit more and dedicate some part of their job for this forgotten public. So there are some good indicators regarding that. In Europe, we have a microfinance platform for all European actors on microfinance, and they have a specific task group working on how they can work more with social excluded people. We have some contact with Action, as I mentioned, that would like to see how they can that request us to be their kind of advisor to be more inclusive for persons with disability. It will take time. It's just the early beginning, but I think it's more mature than 20 years ago, where everybody was thinking that we are just developing ourselves, and then we will bring people with disability with us. We will bring the most vulnerable with our development. But it's wrong, and I think all the studies regarding the development of the economy that should help the poorest to join the development show that it is the contrary. The more you get rich, the more you have poor, and the more you have this distance between poor and rich. So it's even in France and UK and everywhere. So it's a very interesting study that has been done also in New York by Sophie, who spoke this morning, that really show that it is the contrary to what we think generally. So microfinancing are more and more aware of that. For the second question, it's quite difficult for me to imagine how concrete. I don't have concrete stories about multinationals. They have their foundation most of the time. So you can go through foundation, and sometimes they finance microfinance. But no, I don't have a concrete clue of experience working with a multinational on microfinance directly, because I don't think they have direct impact when recruiting people that would have been maybe self-employed before, and now they could be their employees. So that could be a way to look for. But for the moment, I just see some contact with the foundation of the multinationals that are very interesting in children, but sometimes with also some other issues, and sometimes they care about microfinance and economic development. But most of the time, they are more interested in how they can recruit persons with disability in their industries than really looking for self-employment. And it's fine for me for the moment. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. I think we have one room for one more question, or not? Does anyone? Yeah. I mean, but it has to be brief because we have like no. I'm sorry, it's break time? Okay, so it's break time. So maybe you can all talk with our panelists during the break. Thank you very, very much for sharing these extraordinary experiences from three different perspectives. And much luck with your efforts and with the defense of the right to employment for you all. Thank you very much.
So the dessert break, it's time for dessert, is just across the hall where you were this morning. Thanks.